In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we take a brief look at two billionaires in the world, Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, through the writings of Miles Mathis. Miles is an accomplished artist, painter, and published a book in 2010 on physics, with a focus on the history of theoretical physics and mathematical anomalies. His essays are very interesting in a type of analysis that pulls apart lies and half-truths within events or biographies of people who come out of nowhere with fully formed lives and sometimes millions of dollars. We look into Miles' essay on Elon Musk, whose offhand comments often get picked up by news sources and distributed widely. Miles Mathis also wrote an essay on Mark Zuckerberg, an American programmer, internet entrepreneur, and philanthropist. Mark is the chairman, chief executive, and co-founder of the social networking website Facebook. But first, we'll take a look at the essay on Elon Musk. It's titled, "I Don't Believe in Elon Musk," by Miles Mathis. Elon Musk is supposed to be worth $13.6 billion. He's supposed to be the CEO of Tesla Motors. He's supposed to be the founder of SpaceX. He's supposed to be the founder of SolarCity. He's supposed to be the inventor of Hyperloop. I, for one, don't believe any of it. Elon Musk looks to me like a person totally manufactured by intelligence as the fake human front for all these fake projects. In this way, he is exactly like Mark Zuckerberg, another person I've outed as a probable manufactured entity. When I wrote that paper on Zuckerberg, he was also alleged to be $13.6 billion. Coincidence? No. Why do I think that? I think it because Musk's entire Wikipedia page and biography reads like a red flag. Although we will cover the other red flags, I want to skip ahead to the end to lead with later red flags that demand our early attention. I want to lead with them, although they come later on the Wikipedia page. Musk has claimed he is a big fan of Margaret Thatcher. Only fascists and plants are fans of Margaret Thatcher. No real person of any intelligence and scruple is a fan of Margaret Thatcher. Musk is sold as a progressive, but no progressive would claim to be a fan of Thatcher. It doesn't fit his profile at all. We can only imagine it was worked into his biography as either a clue for people like me or as part of some late promotion of Thatcher and fascism in general. Actually, I assume it's mainly another plug for privatization. Musk's entire biography is a long plug for privatization. Along with deregulation, privatization is one of the two main planks of neo-fascism. Musk has said he is, quote, socially liberal and fiscally conservative. Was Thatcher socially liberal? Not according to Section 28, which made, quote, promotion of homosexuality illegal, which stopped just short of making homosexuality itself illegal again, as in the time of Oscar Wilde. I should think this would be of some concern to Musk, since I really don't buy either one of his marriages. But he doesn't have to be concerned with that, does he? Since he lives in the United States in 2016, not in the UK in 1980. In the US in 2016, homosexuality is being promoted like never before. So why don't I buy his marriages? Well, in answer to that, I send you the pictures of Musk with his wives and girlfriends. Just Google something such as Musk with Riley. While any normal heterosexual guy would be getting all the sugar he could from these sweeties, glowing in the perfume, Musk always looks highly uncomfortable. The girls are often leaning away from him, as pictured, and look at his hand in his pocket. Discomfort signs all over the place. Or you can read this 2010 article at Marie Claire, written by his alleged first wife, Justine. You may find it convincing, but I don't. Just look at the lead photo for the article. There's a picture from that article in 2010. Listeners, it does look very staged. I draw your attention to the three tricycles and two bikes. This is to remind us that Musk is supposed to have 5 sons by this woman. Not only do we not get photos of the children, which is perhaps understandable, she doesn't mention them once in the article, either by name or in any other way. Mostly, she just repeats a story of Musk's rise to fame and fortune, with the occasional plug of her own. Very strange. I would have to say it's the most impersonal article of its kind I've ever read. No, it's beyond impersonal. It's almost chilling. It reads like it was put together by a committee, and it may have been. I say that because if we do a people search on Elon Musk, we find no evidence of these children in the computers. In fact, Intellius doesn't even have an Elon Musk listed in California. Only his father, Errol Musk. Instant Checkmate lists an Elon Musk related to Justine, but the only relation is a Jennifer, since Justine's middle initial is J. I assume Jennifer is also her. If these 5 boys have birth certificates, they should be in the computers. They aren't. Then we have to read this. Musk is a self-described American exceptionalist and nationalist, describing himself as, quote, nauseatingly pro-American. According to Musk, the United States is, quote, inarguably the greatest country that's ever existed on Earth, describing it as, quote, the greatest force for good of any country that's ever been. Musk believes outright that there, quote, would not be democracy in the world if not for the United States. Nauseating? Yes. Believable? No. Again, no real person of intelligence would be caught saying that in the second decade of the 21st century. Even the American Nazi Party is more circumspect than that. Musk had obviously been hired to read these lines provided him by the Pentagon or someplace. Except that even the Pentagon isn't that jingoistic these days. Now that I think of it, this reads like a copy provided Musk by Henry Kissinger of the CFR. But even in that context, it's over the top. When I read quotes like this, I have to imagine that clues have been inserted into Musk's biography on purpose by someone. I begin to think this is all part of some game, a nationwide contest to see if anyone can see through this. If so, send me the prize. Again, this is written by Miles Mathis, and yes, Miles, you do deserve the prize, I would agree. And the essay continues. Although I may be the first to propose Musk is an Intel creation, I'm not the only one who has noticed that he appears to be reading from neocon or fascist cue cards. Policy Mike and other sites have criticized Musk harshly for contributing to anti-science Republican candidates, and groups like Longhorn PAC and the NRCC, confirming my analysis above by saying that these political calculations betray Musk's persona of a socially conscious entrepreneur. His many interviews also betray his created persona of a person with very high intelligence and skills. Although he's sold as some sort of Tony Stark, he comes off as Ron Howard with a bit more hair and a foreign accent. I don't see any spark there, and in my opinion, he looks like just another hired actor. Unfortunately, he's not even a good actor, and if he hadn't been born into a rich family, he would have had to work as a crisis actor. Although Musk's companies have received $5 billion in government subsidies, Musk says he isn't in favor of government subsidies for his companies like his. Instead, he has come out in favor of a carbon tax. Obviously, he's just reading from the teleprompter again there, and isn't concerned with appearing to be consistent. Fake people fronting fake companies don't have to worry about appearing consistent. It's all about stirring your mind into mush. The people behind Musk want all the subsidies they can drink, but then they want to pretend they don't lust for them like they do. They also don't want you to apply for any subsidies, because they don't need the competition. They don't want you to be subsidized. They want you to be taxed. So why do I think these companies are fake? We'll start with Musk's links to Mike Griffin. Griffin was head of NASA from 2005 to 2009. But on Musk's page, we learn that Griffin also worked for NQTEL, the venture capital arm of the CIA. That's probably the biggest red flag on the entire page. Curiously, that information has been scrubbed off Griffin's own page. Well, what exactly is NQTEL? NQTEL invests in high-tech companies for the sole purpose of keeping the Central Intelligence Agency and other intelligence agencies equipped with the latest in information technology in support of United States intelligence capability. That's the key to unlocking this whole mystery, so I suggest you read it several times to let it sink in. I suggest not only did InQtel invest in all of Musk's companies, it actually created them and him. We know the CIA creates many front companies since the mainstream admits it, but it is usually assumed they do this to facilitate domestic covert operations of various sorts. A significant part of the U.S. infrastructure is an illusion created to facilitate a variety of treasury dips by the very wealthy. Actually, the mainstream press has already reported on a small part of these thefts and grafts. See, for example, Matt Taibbi's Rolling Stone reports on the big banks, especially this 2013 report titled Everything is Rigged. However, even Taibbi has not yet seen that it's not only via rigging that the rich are becoming richer, it's also via manufacturing fake companies, fake portfolios, and fake projects by which the Treasury can be milked and bilked of billions of dollars of subsidies, grants, and other monies. Well, listeners, this is really interesting. I've not considered this when you're thinking, oh, where does this money come from? Well, it's coming from the taxpayer. So they create a fake company, and then they become subsidized by the U.S. government. So if you thought my mention of intelligence in paragraph one was just a conspiracy theory, think again. Musk had admitted ties to the CIA through Griffin, if nowhere else. You see, before he was hired to head NASA, Griffin was working with Musk on SpaceX, trying to buy old ICBMs from Russia. Again, could you ask for a bigger red flag? Griffin and Musk were in Russia in 2002, trying to buy intercontinental ballistic missiles. We're told one of the Russian engineers spat on Musk, which is about the only thing that makes sense on the entire page. They could probably see he was a spook baby. Musk also had some parallels to Yuri Milner, the Russian billionaire, who, we're told, is the money for the Fundamental Physics Prize. Like Milner, Musk went to the Wharton School of Business. He also went to the University of Pennsylvania, which has come up in my previous papers. Both Ezra Pound and Noam Chomsky were probably recruited from there. But back to SpaceX. The whole project stinks of a con. We're told, in 2001, Musk conceptualized Mars Oasis, a project to land a miniature experimental greenhouse on Mars, containing food crops growing on Martian regolith in an attempt to regain public interest in space exploration. That idea is ridiculous for so many reasons, it's hard to know where to start. Food crops on Mars? Wouldn't the transport costs back to Earth be a little high? Talk about a carbon footprint. Before we start growing food on Mars, shouldn't we hit a few other things first, like, say, getting people there? And who's going to eat that food? I guess they can feed it to the ground squirrels we've seen in NASA's fake pictures on Mars. It wasn't any of the Mars anomaly photos that convinced me the Mars missions were faked. It was watching this NASA press conference for the Curiosity lander. I recommend you watch it without any later commentary added, so that you can be completely objective. Just ask yourself if these guys seem like real scientists. Notice that they're unable to answer any substantive questions from the audience. Only after you've watched these NASA guys should you return to the anomaly photos. Once you do, your mind will be in a more receptive state, and you'll start to see what is there. We're told Musk gave up on the ICBMs, which Russia wanted $8 million apiece for, deciding he could get the materials for only $240,000. Okay, let me see if I understand this. We're being told the materials to build a rocket large enough to carry an entire greenhouse to Mars will cost only $240,000. In that case, I think we've been overcharged for the Apollo missions, for which we were billed about $110 billion. I think we may be overcharged now for the B-2 fighter bomber jets, which cost up to $2.4 billion apiece. Nevertheless, we are told Musk invested $100 million of his fortune into SpaceX, which brings us to his fortune. At age 24, right out of college, Musk invested $28,000 of his dad's money in a company called Zip2. We're told this company developed an internet city guide for newspapers, then going online in 1995. That story is so full of holes. You can't start a company with $28,000, at least not one that you then sell 4 years later for $341 million to Compaq. We're told Zip2 provided online publishing for media companies and had a contract with the New York Times, but the New York Times had been computerized since 1976 and online since 1981. By 1995, it would have already had all the customized portals it needed. Compaq also had no use for Internet City Guidelines and online publishing portals in 1999, so this sale looks manufactured. I'm not the only one noticing that. Take the last link to Quora.com and you'll see that a lot of people are asking questions about Elon Musk. It looks to me like this Zip2 story is being told to explain the genesis of Musk's fortune. The same can be said for Musk's alleged involvement with PayPal. At age 28, Musk founded another company using $10 million from his $22 million profit from selling Zip2. This company, X.com, immediately merged with Confinity, which contained PayPal. So Musk had absolutely nothing to do with founding PayPal, and even according to the mainstream story, was only used for his money. He came in on the merger and was only 28, so why would he have been CEO? No answer. Also, no answer to how he was able to leave the merger just 3 years later with $165 million. That's a three-year return on an investment of 1,500%. If PayPal was already so profitable in those early years, enough to buy out Musk to the tune of $165 million, why bring him in the first place? With big early investors like Deutsche Bank and Nokia, why would Confinity allow Musk to waltz in and soak up a large part of those profits? In other words, with money from a source like Deutsche Bank, why did they need Musk's paltry $10 million? My guess is all these companies are intelligence fronts, and intelligence just inserted Musk into the story later. Which brings us back to SpaceX. Curious, there's no mention on Musk's Wikipedia page of the explosion of the Falcon 9 in June of 2015. Also, no mention of it on the SpaceX page. Also curious that the footage from space.com of the SpaceX capsule Dragon docking with the ISS looks fake. I encourage you to watch it and come to your own conclusions, but to me it looks like nothing but a series of anomalies. The ISS looks like a plastic model. I'm just surprised they can do a better job faking this. NASA's real budget must have dropped below six figures if they can't hire Hollywood people to create something better than this. I honestly don't understand why they spend $108 million on a movie like The Martian, but spend $10,000 faking this docking sequence with the ISS. I guess they know that millions will pay $10 to be propagandized by Hollywood, but only a handful will watch this free release from NASA. The valuation of SpaceX is also a red flag. According to the mainstream story, Musk invested $100 million. Founders Fund invested another $20 million. The first launch was estimated by Musk to happen in 2003, just 15 months after the company started. But there was still no launch in early 2012, 9 years later. Despite that, the value of the company in early 2012 was said to have ballooned to $1.3 billion. Based on what? After the alleged launch in May of 2012, the company's value ballooned again to $2.4 billion. But SpaceX is a private company, the only profit for which is made in supplying the International Space Station. Why would NASA hire a private company to do that? Surely NASA wouldn't have put the ISS into semi-permanent orbit without a way to supply the astronauts with food, right? Weren't they getting food before 2012? Yes. Why should the federal government give huge subsidies to a private company to form so that this company could do what NASA was already doing? To see what I mean in more detail, remember that a large part of Musk's alleged fortune comes from SpaceX. According to published numbers, about $2 billion of his wealth comes from SpaceX stock. So basically, NASA has paid Musk that amount to do what it was already doing. This is one great argument against privatizing things and for keeping them as government projects. In NASA projects, they don't have directors they have to pay $100 million salaries to. So even if SpaceX is a real project, it isn't clear why space funding has moved from public to private. My assumption is the project is mostly fake. And that answers the question. Space funding has moved to the private sector so that even more money can be sucked from the treasury with even less real outcome and far less oversight. The con job becomes so much easier once it's privatized. Now, let's move on to Tesla Motors. As with PayPal, Musk was not involved in the founding. He also wasn't an engineer or designer. He just came in as a suit with a bag of money. Notice two things about that 2003 photo. One, Musk isn't in the picture. That's Eberhard and Tarpening. Two, the Tesla Roadster is complete. They're not posing with drawings or schematics, are they? They're posing with a car. If you don't believe me, ask Martin Eberhard, who sued Musk in 2009. Among other things, Tesla founder Eberhard claims in the suit that, in his zeal to appropriate Eberhard's legacy, Musk had instead sullied Tesla Motors' integrity and blemished Tesla Motors' reputation and prosperity. He also accused Musk of libel, slander, and breach of contract. Although it's claimed Musk countersued, the suit was eventually settled out of court, which of course means Eberhard won. Musk claims he would show Eberhard's history of Tesla Motors was false, but he never did. Although it's claimed Musk countersued, the suit was eventually settled out of court, which of course means Eberhard won. Musk claimed that he would show Eberhard's history of Tesla Motors was false, but he never did that. He only paid to sweep everything under the rug. Wired, which published these lawsuit stories, claimed in their final title that Eberhard said uncle in the battle of lawsuits, but that is more misdirection. Their author, Chuck Squatriglia, admits in the article that, quote, it's unlikely Eberhard withdrew the suit out of kindness and that, quote, a settlement had been reached. He also admits that the judge refused to dismiss the suit as requested by Musk's attorneys. That indicates that Musk did not actually countersue and that it was Musk who cried uncle. Since Eberhard then took down his website, we may assume Musk paid him very handsomely to do so. He also admits that the judge refused to dismiss the suit as requested by Musk's attorneys. That indicates that Musk did not actually countersue, and that it was Musk who cried uncle. Since Eberhard then took down his website, we may assume Musk paid him very handsomely to do so. Although Eberhard is now saying there were five founders of Tesla, before the settlement he was saying there were only two, himself and Tarpening. The logical conclusion is that those behind Musk bought him off. For enough money, he'll say whatever they want him to. For me, the picture above says it all. And then there's the problem of the valuation of Tesla Motors. According to mainstream sources, it posted profits from the first time in the first quarter of 2013. So how did Musk pull in a 2012 salary of $78.2 million? He's said to be the highest paid CEO in the world for that year, a year in which his company was not profitable. How does that work? As usual, none of this makes any sense. It also makes no sense for Tesla Motors in 2014 to open up all its technology patents, basically giving away everything it knows to its competition for free. We're told this is to speed up worldwide development of electric cars, but once again, it's not believable. The board of directors of a real company would have had Musk fired in a split second for doing something like that. It now looks to me like Musk was probably inserted into Tesla Motors expressly to destroy it. Big Oil may have inserted Musk into Tesla in order to eviscerate the competition from the inside out. I wonder if Eberhard ever considered that possibility. So, listeners, put that in context of the space program as well. Okay. Eberhard appears to have considered that possibility, since remember he said that Musk had, quote, sullied Tesla Motors' integrity and blemished Tesla Motors' reputation and prosperity. But what if Musk didn't just accidentally sully Tesla's prosperity? Again, none of it looks like an accident to me. That possibility is greatly increased by further research. Top Gear in the UK and the New York Times both published or aired very damaging accounts of the Tesla cars, showing they had a range of only 55 miles, a range diminished even further by cold weather. Given that both Top Gear and the New York Times also have intelligence ties, intelligence runs the media in both the US and the UK, you should ask yourself, why would one intelligence front be attacking another? If intelligence genuinely wished to push electric cars via their man Musk, why would they allow these programs to air or publish? The answer is, these programs were intended to damage Tesla Motors. It looks to me like Tesla was infiltrated. I give it 2 more years tops. Finally, we find that Musk gave $10 million this year to the Future of Life Institute. This is curious, since although Musk has said he considers artificial intelligence to be the greatest danger to the future, and although the Future of Life also claims this is one of the greatest dangers, the Institute was actually founded and is advised by a group of techno-fascists, including Stephen Hawking, Max Tegmark, Jan Tallon, Anthony Acquire, George Church, Frank Wilczek, and Stuart Russell. I'll comment on most of them below. Like Musk, all are promoting a matrix future while pretending to be concerned about it. Well, this is interesting. I'm not going to go through this the rest of this essay, but isn't that the MO for geoengineering? The scientists that were promoting geoengineering, that were discussing geoengineering as a proposal and acting very concerned about it, even though it's happening in real time. All right, listeners, that's a little bit of a background on Elon Musk by Miles Mathis. Now, they're talking about artificial intelligence, and I recently watched a movie titled Ex Machina, or Ex Machina, and it's about a 26-year-old programmer at the world's largest internet company. That could be Google, maybe, right? Well, this person wins a competition to spend a week at a private mountain retreat belonging to Nathan, a reclusive CEO of the company. When the programmer arrives at the remote location, he finds that he's got to participate in a strange and fascinating experiment in which he must interact with the world's first true artificial intelligence housed in the body of a beautiful robot girl. Okay, that's the basic plot summary. Now, there's dialogue here which makes you think about what the search engines and social media are doing with all their data. Yes, they're selling it among each other and making a lot of money. But there could be a clue here in this movie. Here's just a little bit of the script. This is Nathan speaking, the CEO of the artificial intelligence company. Here it goes. It was a weird thing about search engines. They were like striking oil in a world that hadn't invented internal combustion. They gave too much raw material. No one knew what to do with it. My competitors were fixated on sucking it up and trying to monetize via shopping and social media. They thought engines were a map of what people were thinking, but actually, they were a map of how people were thinking. Impulse, response, fluid, imperfect. And the implication here is that the data was mined by social media and search engines to insert these refined algorithms into the to modify the behavior of robots running on AI. Makes sense. I could see how that could happen. All right, so that in context with what Miles Mathis wrote on Mark Zuckerberg, an American programmer, internet entrepreneur, and philanthropist. He's the chairman, chief executive, and co-founder of the social networking website Facebook. His net worth is estimated now, this is June 2016, to be $51.2 billion. This essay is titled The Ultimate Fake Person Award by Miles Mathis. When confronted with a whopping lie from a whopping liar, my dad used to say, he'd lie if the truth sounded better. Well, the mainstream media has become that sort of liar. They lie all the time about everything, even things they don't need to lie about. I'll show you one of those things in this paper. Mark Zuckerberg, the alleged inventor of Facebook, was Time's Man of the Year last year. This is 2014. I haven't seen anyone really pull that apart, so here goes. Before I show you the whopping lies, let me just ask you if you think it makes any sense that a guy who started a social media website should be Man of the Year. Remember, this wasn't the first social website. There was, what, MySpace before that? Dozens of others, including Delicious, DeviantArt, Flickr, Friendster, High Five, LinkedIn, Netlog, Orkut, and Zing. Plus, how much genius does it take to put a site like this together? It's not brain surgery. Zuckerberg and some pals put it together in college, in between bong hits and kamikaze shots. And apparently they stole the idea from some frat boys, even stupider than they are. And Zuckerberg lost a judgment and had to pay out a large sum to a couple of rich guys from Harvard. But it gets worse, as usual. It turns out that Zuckerberg only took off after the CIA got involved. If you want to know why Facebook is now the number two site on the web in terms of traffic, instead of MySpace or High Five, you only have to look at who's backing it. Xcel Corporation gave $12 million in startup money to Facebook, and Xcel has direct ties to InQtel. It may even be a secret arm of InQtel, as well as DARPA. What's InQtel? It's a venture capital arm of the CIA, as admitted at places like Wikipedia. What is DARPA? It's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the new technology arm of the U.S. Department of Defense. Part of the new technology of, quote, defense is data mining. In 2002, it became known as DARPA, included the IAO, Information Awareness Office, which was data mining American citizens, according to Wikipedia. Quote, this would be achieved by creating enormous computer databases to gather and store the personal information of everyone in the United States, including personal emails, social networks, credit card records, phone calls, medical records, numerous other sources, without any requirement for a search warrant. After public outcry, the IAO was defunded by Congress in 2003, but even Wiki admits that it persisted, quote, and merely ran under different names. It's alive and well today. Facebook is one of its arms. Furthermore, if you check the terms of service of Facebook, you'll find that Facebook now owns any and all information and content you've uploaded to it. They now own copyright to any photos you put up there, including photos of art. They can make, quote, derivative copies of your artwork, and you can't sue them for it. You might be able to, but you would be suing in white territory, since no one knows if terms of service agreements like this will hold up in court. Just as you can't sign away a liability, it may be you cannot sign away copyright in a TOS. But good luck. This also applies to written art, including poems, short stories, jokes, and everything else. In the same way, you've signed away any right to privacy, since the Facebook agreement states in clear terms that they have the right to data mine you any way they like. In signing up to Facebook, you're basically giving a thumbs up to the government to data mine you, with no legal repercussions. You're also giving them a thumbs up to steal your intellectual property, supposing you have any. But that still isn't all. What if you change your mind about something you posted at Facebook, on Facebook, and you wish to take it down? Well, they have a permanent copy of it. You can take it down, but they still have the permanent file, and always will. What if you wish to post something Facebook doesn't like, such as a link to an anti-CIA rally? Well, Facebook can just take it down without even notifying you. They can break all your links and punish all your friends by breaking their links too. Facebook has already done stuff like this. It's almost impossible to stop them. That's a beautiful way to get around free speech, right? You have to sue them to have free speech, but by the time you get around to winning your lawsuit, the rally is over. Ever wonder how Facebook gets so many hits? Those are faked as well. As proof, just go to your sidebar, or wherever your computer history is, click on it. If you're like me, you'll probably find a lot of Facebook hits, even though you haven't been there all day or all year. I'm not a member of Facebook, and never have been, and never go there. And yet my history list is littered with Facebook hits. How can that be? It can be because tens of thousands of websites are surreptitiously linked to Facebook, so that any time you visit those sites, you also register a hit for Facebook. This drives the hits of Facebook up by many factors of 10, falsifying its popularity. This false popularity can then be used to sell ads, driving up Facebook's claimed revenues. The popularity of Facebook is manufactured. That is a whopping lie, but there's an even larger one. We're told that Zuckerberg is worth something on the order of $13.6 billion. This was written in around June of last year. That's up from $4 billion last year, according to Forbes. Well, since Forbes, like Time, and everything else, is now edited by the CIA, we don't have to believe that. If we're smart, we assume that's another lie. Everything else we're told is false, so that probably is too. Can I prove it? Yes. All I have to do is a little math. The revenue of Facebook was around $2 billion in 2010, according to Wiki. The total revenue from 2006 to 2009 was $1.25 billion. Before that, Facebook was nothing special, making only a few million. That is a total, since founding, of $3.25 billion. Zuckerberg can't profit more than the entire company, can he? Zuckerberg owns a 24% share of Facebook. Well, 24% of $3.25 billion is $780 million, not $13.6 billion. Plus, $3.5 billion is revenues, not profit. Facebook has to pay costs, right? It has to pay a staff and rent and so on, which probably brings Zuckerberg's share down below half a billion. That is assuming we aren't being lied to about revenues. Where did they come up with that $13.6 billion number? Well, Goldman Sachs has just paid $400 million for 8% of the company, which would make the company worth $50 billion, we're told. That would make Zuckerberg's share $12 billion. Unfortunately, that's not how you determine the worth of an individual. That's market speculation. And as we've seen, market speculation doesn't always pan out. Goldman Sachs is betting that Facebook will be worth more than $50 billion in the near future, but that bet doesn't put any real money in Zuckerberg's bank account. Assuming that Zuckerberg's living costs are zero, and that he hasn't blown it all on houses, boats, and hookers, his bank account has a maximum of about half a billion. That is how any normal person would determine wealth. To see how skewed this all is and how dishonest, we can compare Zuckerberg to Steve Jobs. Forbes tells us that Jobs, the owner of Apple Computers, is worth $8.3 billion. Do you really believe that Zuckerberg is worth 61% more than Jobs, a man who had produced and sold actual products since 1976? I don't. What I believe is that Zuckerberg is being promoted with false numbers in order to get everyone to sign up to Facebook so that they can be data mined, wallet mined, and whipped with legal pencils. I believe that Goldman Sachs was instructed to bet on Facebook just for this purpose. Goldman Sachs has long been like a fourth branch of the government, and they've long been in bed with the CIA and Department of Defense and so on. Goldman Sachs has more ex-officers in the government than any other company. These appearances in the media by Zuckerberg are also paid for by the U.S. government. Zuckerberg appears on the Ask Men lists, the Time lists, the Forbes lists, and so on, care of the U.S. government. He is a CIA creation. He now does nothing but get his picture taken. He produces nothing. He's not a genius. He's just a name, a face, another useful dupe of the powers that be. He may not even be able to keep his money. I think it's entirely possible that he is just a front and doesn't even exist as a real financial entity. That is, it's entirely possible that he has nothing in his bank account, and that he exists solely as at the discretion of the CIA. They give him a big house and some toys to keep up the charade and tell him to keep his mouth shut. Right now, taking a look at the top news stories with the words artificial intelligence, you may be surprised at how certain tech companies would like to change your world. Here's some of the headlines. Andy Rubin, Android founder, artificial intelligence may be key to all connected things. Artificial intelligence fools humans with realistic sounds. Trainee robot office manager Betty starts 2-month trial as artificial intelligence. Apple rolls out privacy-sensitive artificial intelligence. Can artificial intelligence software transform transportation? Robot, which can choose to harm humans, sparks artificial intelligence debate. Elon Musk's artificial intelligence. Twitter has been aflame with a pronouncement from Elon Musk. According to the visionary entrepreneur, the odds are very high that we're living in a version of the Matrix. Microsoft, other tech giants race to develop machine intelligence. Zuckerberg's first live Q&A will be about Facebook Live and artificial intelligence. I took a sentence out of this article. During Facebook's 2016 Q1 investors call, he again mentioned that the company is working on AI that is better than humans. In 5 to 10 years, he said AI will be able to predict things like what a person will like, where a person is, and who a person will become friends with. I ask, why would it be necessary to have that kind of extremely personal information mapped out and refined to a digitized predictable pattern? This is a dark turn within the mass surveillance masking as social media. I suspect that Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and those working behind the scenes with them are projecting their own warped concepts of the so-called Matrix onto everyone else. What kind of future are these tech giants backed by the CIA preparing for? You have self-driving cars being pushed into the market without much of any demand. Just like the Verichip Corporation promoting the RFID chips embedded under the skin, they're now targeting the tattoo and piercing demographic. The thinking is, what's one more puncture into the skin? And also, just to reflect back on what Miles Mathis highlighted about Musk, and that was privatization of the space program and intelligence shell corporations dipping into the U.S. Treasury. These programs, he says, are designed to fail, to cause destruction and suffering while a few profit. Now, I want to go over a bit of history, and specifically a 1999 testimony of Attorney Bill Shapp on the role of the U.S. government in the assassination of Martin Luther King, because it reveals a lot within the intelligence community and the media. And Attorney Bill Shapp was an expert, and he gave informed testimony on the U.S. government's use of the media to disseminate disinformation via the FBI and CIA. Bill Shapp graduated from the University of Chicago Law School in 1964. And practiced law since then. He was a member of the bar of the state of New York and D.C., and he specialized in military law. In 1978, in addition to being a practicing lawyer, he was a journalist and a publisher and writer specializing in intelligence-related matters, and particularly their relationship to the media. For more than 20 years, he has been the co-publisher of a magazine called Covert Action Quarterly, which particularly deals with reporting on intelligence agencies, primarily U.S. agencies, but also foreign. He published a magazine for a number of years titled Lies of Our Times, which specifically was a magazine about propaganda and disinformation. Okay, here are some of the quotes that he gave during a testimony on the role of the U.S. government in the assassination of Martin Luther King. About a third of the whole CIA budget went to media propaganda operations. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars a year just for that. Close to $1 billion are being spent every year by the U.S. on secret propaganda. The FBI is much harder to get figures for because they don't generally admit to conducting media operations. And unless, until something gets exposed, They have to admit to that particular operation. They deny to an extent where it's really hard to try and estimate how much money is being used by the FBI and by the military intelligence agencies. But it's sort of clear that hundreds of millions of dollars a year are being spent by various aspects of the government on deliberately creating and spreading lies. Here's another quote. And when you associate one thing with another over time, just a mention of one brings the association of the other. What this will sometimes mean is that even when something is later exposed as a lie, if it was accepted as a truth for a long time, the exposure of it as a lie is not believed. It's in one ear and out the other. But when the Church Committee reported on the CIA media operations, for example, beyond friends in the press, beyond having people who were just generally thought along similar lines, it turned out that they had thousands of journalists in their employ. Not merely friendly, not merely agents, not merely someone you could pass a story to, but people who might have appeared to the outside world to be a reporter for CBS was in fact a CIA employee getting a salary from the CIA. Here's another quote by Bill Shapp. 1999. But most people didn't realize the extent of the intelligence media organization. It's fairly incredible. They sort of brag about it. When you read the books about the history of the CIA, one of the heroes was the first man in charge of media operations, a man named Frank Wisner. They referred to his organization as the Mighty Wurlitzer. And there's this image of this guy sitting at one of those giant organs, you know, the 17 keyboards. And you're playing this, sort of like Phantom of the Opera in that scene. And there was the guy running the CIA media operations all around the world. And he really was, because every single city of any size on Earth, he had some employee who supposedly worked for a newspaper or a magazine or a radio station or a wire service, and they could get stories anywhere. Jim said he looked and he saw this guy at a nearby desk sit down and type. This is a CIA officer, an employee of the U.S. government, type an editorial, and then wave goodbye to everybody, left the office. The next morning, that appeared as the editorial, the lead editorial in the largest newspaper in Japan. Now, that level, they didn't go to a friendly publisher and say, gee, we would sort of like it if you could maybe do something a little bit favorable to this issue. They wrote the editorial, they handed it to the guy, and the next day, in Japanese, it appears in the paper. And they thought it was so great to kill Americans that they were putting it on their postage stamps. The only thing that was later learned is that these were not the North Vietnamese stamps. They were CIA forgeries, had never been real stamps, and the CIA was able to have them appear on the cover of Life magazine as if they were the real thing. A major FBI division that was called the Crime Reporting Division was theoretically supposed to keep track of how federal crimes were being reported. Why that was their business, I don't know, but that's what its theory was. But in fact, what it was doing was a whole division set up to keep track of journalists and reporters in magazines and newspapers to decide who could be counted on to write stories that the FBI wanted written, who would slant stories the way they wanted it. The FBI had made relations with the media a key area, not so much infiltrating employees as the CIA did, but cultivating very, very deep connections throughout the American media. They had the entire division of the FBI. The Crime Reporting Division was dealing solely with developing friendly journalists, developing ways in which you can get what you wanted to appear in the papers, to be there, and what you didn't want to be there on a level that nobody realized until these reports came out. The Crime Reporting Division was keeping track of virtually every journalist in America that wrote anything that had to do with the FBI. And whether everything was being classified as friendly or unfriendly, it was somewhat complicated because it generally meant, did J. Edgar Hoover like what they wrote or not like what they wrote? And practically the opinion of nobody else at the FBI mattered while Hoover was alive. But he kept charts on every significant journalist as to who was helpful. And you would look through the reports and the documents that come out. You will see statements by Hoover, and immediate subordinates get his information to friendly journalists. This was a little historic context going back to the testimony of attorney Bill Shapp on the role of the U.S. government in the assassination of Martin Luther King. But specifically, this was informed testimony on the U.S. government's use of the media to disseminate disinformation through the FBI and CIA. And this in context of the essays that Miles Mathis had wrote recently. So if you made it through this whole show, congratulations. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit InOtherNewsRadio.com for archived shows.
say.